A similar attitude about this being sustained in adversity was revealed by Solomon Bailey, who belonged to the same Methodist class meeting with the man who was attempting to sell Bailey's wife and infant daughter. The slave admitted that it was extremely difficult to keep up true love and unity between him and me in the sight of God. This was a cause of wrestling in my mind. But that scripture abode with me. He that loveth father or mother, wife or child, more than me is not worthy of me. Then I saw it became me to hate the sin with all my heart, but still the sinner love. But I should have fainted if I had not looked to Jesus, the author of my faith. Many slaves who remained in bondage contemplated a different escape. I was a member of the First Baptist Church. I heard the white preacher preach, and I thought within myself I would seek a better world. Here I am in bondage, and if there is a better world above, where I shall not be pulled, hauled about, and tormented as I am in this, I will seek it, recalled Henry Atkinson. It would be simplistic, however, to interpret the consolation that Atkinson found in his religion as merely compensatory otherworldliness. And then there's Josiah Henson, who confessed when he got to Connecticut. My conscience used to sometimes to upbraid me with having done wrong after I had run away from my master and arrived in Connecticut. And I went up on a high mountain and prayed to the Lord to teach me my duty, that I might know whether or not I ought to go back to my master. Before I came down, I felt satisfied. And it did seem to me that the Lord heard my prayers. When I was a poor and wretched slave and delivered me out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of bondage, that it was his hand and not my own artfulness and cunning which had enabled me to escape. Faith in God and the kind of prayer that we all understand in times of adversity seem to both sustain and protect the slave as they fought their way through a system over which they had no control. Faith and prayer was a protector. Praying Jacob was a slave in the state of Maryland. His master was very cruel to his slaves. Jacob's rule was to pray 3 times a day. At just such an hour of the day, no matter what his work was or where he might be, he would stop and go and pray. His master had been to him and pointed his gun at him and told him if he didn't cease praying, he would blow out his brains, and Jacob would finish his prayer and then tell his master to shoot in welcome. Your loss will be my gain. I have 2 masters, one on earth, one in heaven. Master Jesus in heaven and Master Sanders on earth, and I have a soul and a body. The body belongs to you, Master Sanders, the soul to Jesus. Jesus says men ought always to pray, but you will not pray, neither do you want to have me pray. Sometimes Mr. Sanders would be in the field about half drunk, raging like a madman, whipping the other slaves, and when Jacob's hour would come for prayer, he would kneel down and pray, but he, Sanders, could not strike the man of God. And then there are others as well. Sometimes they prayed about things that were asked of them. You see, for a while, when the war was going badly, even the plantation owners needed all the assistance with prayer that they could get. So they would ask the slaves to pray for victory. The prayers of the poor slaves are proven to have had great value in the minds of their masters in a score of ways. They argued and begged, coaxed and threatened, broke up meetings, punished to make them pray foe to Confederates. It is proven to have been so far from the fact that so many refer to it as known fact in so many accidental ways. For instance, masters say we pray for the wall. Say we shouldn't, must pray for the Confederates. We pray more, pray harder. Then they wouldn't let us have meetings, broke up the meetings, but didn't broke our hearts. And we pray more and more in the heart, night and day, and wait for the Lord. Oh, we pray for the Lord to come and to hasten his work. A deeply pious ex-slave said, I pray that God bless you and give you success. Master angry. But we must pray for the coming of the Lord and his people. Another said, I knew God would bless you and give a victory. I feel it when I pray. Master angry because I pray for the north. Can't help it. Must pray for the whole world. Master say, no, pray for the Confederates. But I know God must be blessed and all. On our plantation, when the war was going on, there was a great revival, and Mistress called the colored people together and told them to pray mightily that the enemy might be driven back. So we prayed and prayed all over the plantation. About appeared like the more the darkies played, the more the nearer the Yankees come. Then the mistress say, stop all this praying for the enemies. I won't have it. I believe they are praying for the enemies to come, so there was no more praying where mistress could hear it. One day my mistress come out to me and say, Maria, what does you pray for? I prays, missus, that the Lord's will may be done. But you mustn't pray that way. You must pray that our enemies may be driven back. But missus, if the Lord's will to drive them back, then they will go back. Faith sustains believers. Faith became a deliverer for the slave, the troublesome question, according to Aunt Ellen, a freed woman in North Carolina, had not been if the slaves would be free, but when. When we used to think about it, it appeared like the judgment sure to come, but a powerful step off. As that powerful step loomed closer with the beginning and progress of the war, slaves term as had generations of Christians before them in time of crisis to the biblical promises of God for reassurance. Many of the hymns that were sung, slave worship services called spirituals, had an otherworldly character about them, but sometimes that otherworldliness could be reinterpreted to mean this world. We'll soon be free, we'll soon be free, we'll soon be free when the Lord will call us home. My brother, how long, my brother, how long, my brother, how long, for we done suffering here. It won't be long, it won't be long, it won't be long, for the Lord will call us home. We'll soon be free, we'll soon be free, we'll soon be free when Jesus sets me free. We'll fight for liberty, we'll fight for liberty, we'll fight for liberty when the Lord will call us home. Or, oh, Father Abraham, go down in Dixie's land. Tell Jeff Davis to let my people go. Down in the house of bondage, they have watched and waited long. The oppressor's heel is heavy. The oppressor's arm is strong. Oh, Father Abraham. Booker T. Washington, recalling his last days in slavery, made a similar point about the ambiguity of religious imagery in spirituals. As the great day of emancipation grew nearer, there was more singing in the slave quarters than usual. It was bolder, had more ring, lasted later into the night. Most of the verses of the plantation songs had some reference to freedom. True, they had sung these same verses before, but they had been careful to explain that freedom in these songs referred to the next world and had no connection with life in this world. Now they gradually threw off the mask and were not afraid to let it be known that freedom in their songs meant freedom of the body in this world. Faith became a deliverer for the slaveholder as well. One day while in the field plowing, I heard a voice. I looked but saw no one. Everything got dark and I was able to stand any longer. With this, I began to cry, mercy, mercy, mercy. As I prayed, an angel came and touched me, and I looked new. There came a soft voice saying, my little one, I have loved you with an everlasting love. You are a chosen vessel unto the Lord. I must have been in this trance for more than an hour. I went to the barn and found my master waiting for me. I began to tell him of my experiences. My master sat watching and listening to me, and then he began to cry. He turned from me and said in a broken voice, Mort, I believe you are a preacher. From now on, you can preach to the people here on my place. But tomorrow morning, Sunday, I want you to preach to my family and my neighbors. The next morning, at the time appointed, I stood up on two planks in front of the porch of the big house and without a Bible or anything. I began to preach to my master and the people. My thoughts came so fast that I could hardly speak fast enough. My soul caught on fire, and soon I had them all in tears. I told them that they must be born again, and that their souls must be freed from the shackles of hell. To describe slave religion as merely otherworldly is inaccurate. For the slaves believed that God had acted, was acting, and would continue to act within human history. Within their own particular history as a particular people, just as long as he had acted on behalf of another chosen people, biblical Israel. Moreover, slave religion had this worldly impact, not only in leading some slaves to acts of eternal, external rebellion, but also in helping slaves to assert and maintain a sense of personal value, even of ultimate worth. The religious meetings in the quarters, groves, and hushed harbors were themselves frequently acts of rebellion against the proscriptions of the master. In the context of divine authority, the limited authority of any human was placed in perspective by obeying the commands of God, even when they contradicted the commands of men. Slaves developed and treasured a sense of moral superiority and actual moral authority over their own masters. The political ramifications of slavery were evident in the ferocity of the Civil War. Political leaders found their faith to be sustained in hard times as well. Abraham Lincoln's faith was revealed in many of the things he said, but there was no greater testimony than that in his short second inaugural address. The first half of the short speech was a war progress report to the nation, but the second half was a prayer for God's guidance and for the people's understanding of God's purpose. Neither party expected the magnitude or duration which it has already attained, the Civil War. Neither anticipated that the cause of the conflict might cease even before the conflict itself should cease. Each looked for an easier triumph and result less fundamental and astonishing. Both read the same Bible and prayed to the same God. Each invokes his aid against the other. It may seem strange that any man should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But let us judge not that we be not judged. The prayer of both should not be answered. That of neither has been fully answered, for the Almighty has his own purposes. Woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offense come, but woe unto that man by whom the offense cometh. If we shall suppose American slavery one of those offenses which in the providence of God must needs come, but which, having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, that he gives to both North and South this terrible war, as was due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern that there is any departure from those divine attributes which believers in the living God always ascribe to him? Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet if it be God's will that it continue until the wealth piled upon bondsmen by 250 years unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn from the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still must be said that the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and orphans, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. Churches and church people sought the abolition of slavery. The philosophical and financial resources of those who spoke and wrote of injustice found their basis in the church. Whether it was Frederick Douglass or Sojourner Truth, or the folks in Cincinnati and in Xenia and in Wilberforce and in Marysville and Kenton and other places along other state lines that helped to fund the Underground Railroad. Those were backed by the church. And in the midst of all of that, the black church remained and became a continuing strong force within the black community. It sustained community justice when justice was not to be offered in the larger society. Gazing back at their lives of slavery, former slaves affirmed that they had trusted in the Lord and that the Lord had delivered them. Like the children of Israel of old, they had lived through Egypt and Exodus, and the experience had constituted them a peculiar, a chosen people. This identity was to remain in the midst of the chaos, disappointment, and disaster of the Reconstruction, a bedrock hope for freed black Christians as it had been for them as slaves. As the one institution which freed blacks were allowed to control, the church was the center of social, economic, educational, and political activity. It was also a source of continual continuity and identity with the black community. In their churches, black worshipers continued for decades to pray, sing, preach, shout as they and their parents had during slavery. That same black church fostered the civil rights movement. As we know it, it began with the support of a short, frail, tired black woman who refused to move from a seat on a bus, Rosa Parks, the Montgomery bus boycott. It escalated slightly to public accommodations and the Freedom Rides. We can remember pictures of burned Greyhound buses, or were sitting at lunch counters in North Carolina. And finally, it escalated to being the voting rights of black folks who could not have representation under the way the land was structured. It became a direct confrontation with bad law. States did not grant civil rights. It took the power of a federal government to do that. 10 years ago, James Boggs wrote in his book, Racism and the Class Struggle, these words. It is white power which decided whether to shoot to kill, as in Watts, or not to shoot as all in Oxford, Mississippi, against white mobs. To arrest or not to arrest, to break up picket lines or not break up picket lines, to investigate brutality and murder, or to allow these to go uninvestigated. To decide who eats and who goes on city aid when out of work, and who does not eat and does not go on city aid. To decide who goes to what schools and who does not go, who has transportation and who doesn't, what streets are lighted and have good sidewalks and what streets have neither lights or sidewalks, what neighborhoods are torn down for urban renewal and who and what are to go back into these neighborhoods. It is white power which decides which people are drafted into the army to fight and which country this army is to fight at what moment. It is white power which has brought the United States to the point where it is counter-revolutionary to and increasingly despised by the majority of the world's peoples. All these powers are in the political arena, which is the key arena that the black revolutionary movement must take over there is to be serious black power. Boggs may have been naive in assuming the possibility of a black revolutionary takeover, but power is still essential for even ameliorating the conditions of black people and other minorities when we see human injustice. Some things the Voting Rights Act achieved. The number of blacks voting in the South almost tripled since the 1965 Voting Rights Act. While 3.2% of all business managers were minority in 1970, it was 7.2% by 1980. Although about 12% of the population is black, for example, blacks comprise a third of those who get food stamps, live in public housing, receive Medicaid, for there are three times as many blacks living in poverty as white, 32.5% as opposed to 10.2%. Some things have made great strides. We do vote. We do find that there are elected officials by the thousands in the South now, as opposed to the tens or the hundreds before. But human injustice still exists. And in the midst of all of that, I know that there is no way that I can take care of my needs alone. The black church was able to take a theology of hope and make it a politics of hope. And somehow, in the midst of absolute chaos, force a country to do what it did not really want to do. Slavery caused this country a war that no one really wanted to happen, and that this country could truly not afford. Voting rights in the 60s was only one indication of the power that the church had. And that one in particular showed both the power of the black church and the white church. But the white church was also able to give the right to vote for women. It also causes prohibition. Remember, the primary organization was the Women's Christian Temperance Union. Justice for all means being actively involved in securing political change to achieve rights. Our country is based upon a representative type government. As one said earlier this week, or as I said earlier this week, the best kind of government is a monarchy, assuming the monarch is a philosopher. But maybe the next best option is a democratic representative type government. Maybe I can say that because I've seen it work in my own lifetime. I'm not sure that my grandparents or their grandparents felt quite the same way about it. But I've seen it work. And what's our responsibility in that? Our responsibility is not unlike those that the slaves exhibited when they prayed. To be able to isolate the issues and understand what the command of God truly is, at least for us, as we see it, as we understand it, not only for our own selves, but for all of those around us as well. We are to encourage other Christians to be involved in the political climate. We are to read all that is available on the subjects that concern us and interest us. We are to support our church information bureaus, for they do give us information over and above the normal press, over and above that which comes on television. We are to inform church leaders and political leaders of the emerging problems in our own areas. Not to just keep blinking our eyes and think it doesn't exist, but to look seriously at those things which confront our neighbors that may not hurt us, but directly confront our neighbors. If the slaves could pull themselves together in cabins and sing spirituals, despite the fact that the master was saying you don't sing the spirituals, then what other Christian command do we have than to gather one another together to talk about those things which concern us all. We should show a concern for human rights. We do that now in our concern for the people of Namibia. One, because there's injustice. Two, because they are Lutheran. And unfortunately, I'm not sure that the order means anything, but maybe it does. Three, because they're black. We're concerned about our apartheid in South Africa. But our concerns must go beyond just the human needs for justice that we see. For one of the commands is being the body of Christ is that we're also to be the vine dresser of God's world. A vine dresser does not just use it and control it, but he dresses the vine so that it may flourish. That means a concern for the future of our earth and our planet. This particular day, one of my campus ministry colleagues, John Nelson, and Bishop Raymond Hunthausen, and Bishop Gibb Fjellman are taking part in a demonstration at Hood Canal and the coming of the first Trident submarine to be armed, ironically named the USS Ohio, my home state. What we can do with nuclear arms ought to scare all of us. And what we should do about decreasing the number available for use ought to concern all of us. We are God's arms and legs. We are the visible church. We don't have any other choice but to take seriously the scriptures and take seriously the government over which we have some control and make it work. The sermon's over. I'm not sure that there's going to be a comment, Charlie. I can sit and wait.
Do you feel the law can, it has helped the black man? You're kind of saying to the... I mean, I can... It's still love that has to come through someplace or other. And I don't see the black man as much better off than he was probably in slavery. I mean, he's a little better off now.
Given but the still, option, I don't want to go
still
back.
But still, 90% of them are stuck down there. And love hasn't come through yet, as I see it. Or do you, I mean, that's as I see it. I wonder if the black man feels that way also.
When 30% of our people find themselves below what is euphemistically called the poverty line, and we deal with a quote-unquote social safety net, for which I think some people have found massive cracks, then yes, the system is not thoroughly working for all of us. And I think that's part of my responsibility, both as a Christian and as a member of the black community, to say that I've got to fight to see that that changes. It's most difficult when we say that 35% of the black population is on welfare and 10.2% of the white population is on welfare. With 20 million people, 20% of whom are black, that means 80% of over 200 million people, 10% of over 200 million people, which means somewhere around 2.5 to 3 million people are white who are below the poverty line. That ought to be just as much of a concern. I'm not going to deny the fact that I'm concerned about the massive numbers that appear in cities to be below the poverty line who are black. But what I think the civil rights movement showed implicitly was the things that you fight for that that protect the rights of black people also protected the rights of poor whites as well. And somehow it's easy to consider that the poor are one color because we tend to appear, well, we show out the crowd, that's for sure. But, you know, you start forgetting about the masses of people that are your color as well. They blend into the woodwork. You don't notice them as much. Granted, jail populations are overpopulated with blacks, you know, the whole sequence. And I think systemically, no one can disprove that poverty forges the kind of problems we have that bridge into the criminal justice system. And that's a political problem then. Whether it's overcrowded jails or how we correct criminals or how we retrain people to enter society. It's not just my problem, it's our problem. And we've got to get serious about that. I wish I could remember exactly the figures in the passage, but there are three countries who are still building jails. South Africa, the Soviet Union, and the United States. Now somehow, I think I'd like to get out of that pattern. That's not just for the sake of black folks in prison. It's for the sake of all of our lives and all of our living and all of our comforts and all of the blessings that we have. I'm preaching again.
What do you think is the proper way to approach the question of raising the poverty level? It seems like what we've done so far has not worked. I mean, using the old Chinese proverb, you know, you give a man a fish and he eats for a day, you teach him how to fish and he knows how to save himself. It seems like we've given out fish, is all we've done. We haven't done that much in trying to change the way of life. So I feel like you pass out a crumb off the master's table, so to speak, if you use that expression. And to fight for more of that, maybe it's not the way to do it. I don't know. What's your thoughts on that?
Hoping I'm hearing you and not shortchanging it. Politically, we deal with a double-bladed shaver every morning. One is, it costs money to retrain people into marketable skills. And two, we don't like to pay taxes. And that's one bullet we have really walked around. We don't want to bite it.
There are some people that are busy touring the mine and their neighborhoods because they're kind of getting wilted under the hot sun today. But I can tell you on behalf of 90 plus people that came up here today and for countless others that they appreciate everything you've done to make the former residents feel very welcome. And there'll probably be double the number of people, former residents, that will be at Chelan tomorrow for their annual picnic at the city park. It's kind of nice to know that that Holden Village, under the Lutherans, Holden Village has been in existence now longer than Holden Mine as a producing mine was. It's kind of hard for some of us who left here 25 years ago to understand that, but that's truth.
As much as people can talk about waste and fraud, and I will not deny that it exists, I think the highest estimates of waste and fraud in any of our developmental programs from the Great Society on probably come out somewhere between 10 and 12%. And what we do is we spike the other 80 or 90% for the sake of 10. There are statistical facts available, numbers of people who went into training programs and got off welfare and have stayed off welfare. But are we willing to bite the bullet of what it costs to make this society available to have working people across the board? I made a flippant comment a couple of days ago about the cost overruns in the Trident submarine. The initial costs were expected to be $600 million. The final cost of the Ohio was $1.2 billion. I think that could buy us an awful lot of social programs to help people, to help all of us. Yeah. I'm not just talking about the cost of something, I'm just talking about the overruns.
Going on a step further, do you think that the private sector can ever absorb all the trained people that could be trained if they were trained? So let me put it in the paper. Or should the government be the employer of last resort? So it's, in other words, the projects we had back in the 30s, the WPA, the CCC, and things like that. In fact, I still see stamps and concrete around WPA 1935, something like that. They're enduring, you know.
But thank God for the WPA, we wouldn't have parks and zoos.
Well,
it's true. I wish I could say honestly I knew an answer to that. Economists that I have talked to and that I have learned from don't have an answer either. I think the one clear vision we have of the private sector, especially the top 50 and the Fortune 500, is that they are not willing to invest money in people or in new research and development. They are willing to invest money in profit-making other corporations. In Ohio this year, our biggest one was Marathon Oil. They fought a takeover by Mobil. When you start talking, and then the irony is the bailout came not from, you know, just being dropped. It came from United States Steel. Yeah. God knows why. They're buying an oil company. You know, in the midst of, you know, the kind of competition they're getting from Japan. That money, I think, could be better used for R&D and new equipment. I really have a tough time with the private sector. It's got to be the place where it happens. And we know that in the past, they have provided jobs for those who have been trained. But the biggest problem right now is that Wall Street doesn't trust the private sector to do that. They know that their money is going to be used for other kinds of things, which then essentially end up in profits. But it's a very strange ball game right now. Everybody's running scared. Nobody wants to lose. Nobody wants to bite the bullet of what's going to happen with their money. One of the things that scares me about our current administration, and this came from Jim Crumley in a couple of meetings in which I heard the same story twice. As he was talking about the social service safety net and the role of private enterprise in being much more of the benevolence in a local area, he felt that the church, this is Ronald Reagan, should be that place where charity is exercised. Someone estimated that the combined total of the cuts in social benefits, more than what's 40 times what the current income of churches is. That's the kind of ballpark we're talking about. It means churches would have to raise 4 times the amount of money we are currently giving.
40.
To do what Ronald Reagan is asking the churches to do. Because he feels the churches are part of the private sector.
Did he ask the churches to do that?
Yes.
There were representatives from the National Council of Churches, representatives from Lutheran Council USA. Jim Crumley was there. I'm not sure whether David Preuss was there. There were also Jim Bakker, Pat Robertson, those who quite well agreed. And in the question and answer period, the questions were like the press conference. They were pretty much managed. And so there was one question from the liberal side and a couple of questions from the conservative side. But even in that exchange, it essentially said, the role of charity belongs to the church and not to the federal government. And social services for those who are below a certain income level are designed to be the charity of the church. That's the administration's stance. And I'm trying to say that without a lot of prejudice. I know it comes through.
Getting back to the education and training issue, one small thing, though, that I think that we could do in our cities, I know in San Antonio recently, the funds for the Literacy Council were held back, and so volunteerism was really important with that council. And people getting their GED is really important. And of course, in San Antonio, we have the language difficulty, and people volunteering for something like that. That is something that we as high school graduates could help in a very small way, but something that doesn't cost anything and could help people qualify for a high school degree.
I think it was a couple of months ago in one of the church packets, and I can't remember whether it was the AIM packet or the Lutheran or the ALC packet, but there was a short little blurb which talked about a brochure which would help members of congregations who were high school graduates really understand that they can be teachers of English as a second language, that you don't have to be a language major and understand the person's native tongue. And trying to open up those kinds of avenues for that kind of volunteerism. Our churches are providing those kinds of assistances, and that's already happened.
Well, what percentage of our population are active members of congregations anyway?
Active?
Yeah, active. Because that's what Reagan is saying, that the churches and the active people in those churches should take up charity. Okay, what percentage of our society is going to have to bear that burden?
Well, they tried to make that clear that not everybody belongs to church.
Well, what is the percentage? Does anybody
I don't know.
Is
don't
it
know.
30 or 70 or?
I have no idea.
Closer to
30.
You
indicated that the black church during slavery was a sustaining institution for the black people. What role do you see the black church playing now?
A lot of folks are beginning to question that. And one of the more unique ways of dealing with it has been one that the African Methodist Episcopal bishops have been doing. One of the current professors at Union Theological Seminary and a liberation theologian, James Cone, has become in some ways the house theologian for the African Methodist Episcopal bishops. It was a church charged with revolution. It was a church charged and committed to radical stewardship. Their history says that they were a part of the United Methodist Church. A good number of the members were a part of a congregation in central Philadelphia. They helped build the church. They helped expand the church. They had worshipped in the side aisles for a while. They even built a balcony when the church got too small. And then they even agreed to be consigned to the balcony to worship. And at one point during one of the worship services, the Right Reverend Richard Allen, who was the founder of the African Methodist Episcopal Church, Absalom Jones, who did not go to the AME Church but became the first Episcopal priest, and several members were down at the main rail praying. And the white deacons of the church asked them to remove themselves to the balcony railing and pray there. And Richard Allen looked up and said, "If you don't mind, sir, I'd like to finish my prayer here, and we will leave you never to bother you again." And that's the way the AME Church started. Now, that kind of radical, just up and leave. And what they have sensed in themselves is that they have become a complacent church. And they're now trying to once again find that radical nature, that growing nature, so that they can once again become very active and sensitive to the needs of peoples in their communities. Now that's starting with the bishops, which is kind of a different place for it to start. Other churches are becoming much more active. Talk to a member of a Christian Methodist Episcopal Church who's got his 20 years in with the government as an engineer. And he's starting to talk to some of his friends who are in that same ballpark about taking over one of the factories that's vacant in our town to see what kind of industry, what kind of products are needed. And he's interested in going to the churches and saying, you folks fund this. We don't want to go to the banks. We want you to fund it so it can truly be the communities. I'm not saying that's happening everywhere, but there are some significant examples where the black church has been leading in certain areas. Probably the biggest example that most people use is Leon Sullivan's Opportunities Industrialization Commission, OIC, privately funded and throughout the United States, but got its impetus out of his congregation in Philadelphia.
I have one comment on a whole different subject, which you mentioned about the top 50 corporations. Put a good word for them anyway. I worked for Xerox Corporation. And I had the privilege 6 months this past winter working at the school for the retired, establishing a microcomputer center, training some of the kids and teachers on how to use it. And I was given the full leave of absence from my company, from Xerox. Full pay, full benefits, and guaranteeing my job, which I've got back now. And other things Xerox does too. Local communities where they are. And so we have programs like that. And I view them as the same thing, I think, similar nature.
Yeah, we've had a couple of Xerox instructors visiting lectures in our math and science departments as well. I'm not saying that the companies are all doing evil things.
Okay, I mean, they are, yeah. Yeah, we are doing some programs like this.
But
there's about, I think about 20 of us are involved up to a year off.
I think we have to read very carefully what's happening with those who are making profits and what's happening with their profits. Are they in the process of creating more jobs, or is the money being invested in some other kinds of areas? I guess your question really intrigues me, though, because I'm not a member of a black church. What I guess I'm trying to say is that the challenge is to the white church to become radically involved as well.
I think another thing, though, that the church has a real responsibility is to learn what are the problems. Why did U.S. Steel divert their funds? I think probably before we talk about it, we have an obligation to learn their problems. Why didn't the oil companies have the refinery capacity in the 70s? Why were their profits low? Why wouldn't they reinvest? What was it that created these decisions?
But the catch is, if not, their profits are high.
Are they high?
Yes.
Percentage-wise?
Yes. I think you can find any major business publication will tell you that the windfall profits by oil companies over the last 2.5 years have been massive.
I don't know. All I know is we've got a profit-sharing fund. And because of the lack of profits, the people that invest the money have diverted it from energy because the profits aren't there. They're putting them into areas. You know, why has the stock gone down so low if their profits are there?
I can't answer that question, but
this,
I think...
I feel that the church has a real obligation to learn, you know, why they do those things. Because a lot of those people are real good Christians that I'm sure are the executives of these companies.
I don't doubt that at all.
Yeah. So I feel that we have an obligation.
But I think there are some things that we have not learned from other corporate entities, other countries. I think probably the biggest managerial mistake is it exists in Detroit, where there is now one of the cities with the largest unemployment in the country. They made management problems in our major auto-producing companies to say that they would not compete with smaller cars coming from foreign lands. That was a management decision. And now all of us as a country are paying the price of a bad management decision.
You say they said they wouldn't?
They decided not to. That's been editorial comment in Detroit News, Automotive News, and other publications that I've been reading, which are trade publications for that business.
The Fortune magazine business. Yep. What's going on?
I think that shows one of the things, the tremendous complexity of the issues, and how so often we would like to do one thing. We enter an issue of, say, unemployment. We want to create jobs. But you can never do just one thing, because at the same time we're interested in other things. So that you have people who want lower gas prices, but also want to make sure that their retirement fund, which might have a heavy investment in particular oil stocks, gets a high return, which means high profits, and you can't have both. Or you want to slow down the growth of the economy because we feel that we are producing too much, we're taking too much of the world's resources, etc., creating a no-growth or a minus-growth economy, and yet we want to create new jobs, and we can't do that. And I think that the things we have to learn are, one, how tremendously complex the world is, and really how little most of us do know about economics. For example, I caught the comment you made about a management decision. I agree that a management decision was made in Detroit, but I doubt that we could find a person who made it.
The buck's got to stop someplace.
Somebody becomes responsible for it. But I think that's not the same thing as being able to say that he made it. So you get a corporation that acts not on the basis of the activity of an individual corporate manager, but the corporation does it. And I think this is where someone said, I believe that the majority of people who run the major corporations are good Christians. They don't beat their wives and they give money and take care of the kids and everything. Just like the ones who were in political power during Vietnam were not bad people. They were nice people, good neighbors, etc. But somehow they were the ones responsible during the time that we entered Vietnam, or the ones responsible for management decisions in Detroit. They're responsible, but did they have the authority? And I think that's where the difference between the activity of a corporation as an entity and the individual people within it. I don't think we're in a situation anymore where one person can change a corporation.
I'm saying one person can.
And inside?
Rosa Parks didn't get up from her seat in a bus.
Well, can you do that in a major business sector, though, that works throughout the world? Because I don't think any one person, I don't think a corporation allows any one person that kind of authority.
You blended a couple of things.
Okay.
One is, if a corporate decision does not have an ultimate responsible person, then I think corporate management's in serious trouble. That's number one. Number two, you blended the fact that government makes decisions too. We have a elected representative government, and yes, I hold my representatives accountable for the decisions they make. And if we don't, then I think we are creating an act of sin.
We make them responsible.
We hold them responsible for their decisions.
But most of the time we hold them responsible for what has not been done.
I think sometimes we also make them responsible for what is being done. I think a good number of liberal people were voted out of office because they supported abortion this past year.
Could they?
So, yeah, whether or not you agree with abortion or not, because they made a stance on an issue, I think some people who tend to be in the liberal sector were voted out of office. Rightly or wrongly, that was because of what they stood for, what they backed, what they supported. And I think that's part of the risk we have to take, whether we're the people who are in politics directly, the people who work for politicians, or the people who vote and make those decisions about who stays in office. We make those decisions and we hold them accountable.
Well, I think we have another. I said something about major corporations. It's just like you mentioned the auto industry. And when the war did end, MacArthur took all our best consultants that he could find and brought them to Tokyo, taught them quality circles. Now we're sending people over there to find out how our quality circles work.
Well, plus
it's very easy for us. It's so easy to find wrong and to criticize, but how is it you can do something constructive and encourage the positive? Because we did take our consultants and give them everything we could to help them. And they took this and they really put it to use.
They learned.
They learned.
They really did. And now we're going back over learning what we taught them.
Why did we forget?
Did we forget, or did we get too lackadaisical?
Either way. Either way. What is it about us that somehow says that we could not maintain the kind of consistent, dogged attitude about making it work?
Yeah. And see, the same thing is, what were the incentives that were taken away from these large corporations? You know, for them not to do some of the things that they should have done, because now hindsight is very easy to look at.
I think the largest turning point was the oil embargo and oil prices that were being held down artificially, and we were prepared for that. Before, when cars were sold like hotcakes, it was easy to sell cars. They were making them simply, but they used a lot of gasoline, and we just were caught with our cars down. And then in 1974, I think Ford Corporation, from what I've read, announced boldly that they were not downsizing cars and they would not do research. And that was awfully close to a one-person decision. I don't know if it was Henry Ford Jr. or not, but we didn't respond to that change. But before then, Volkswagens were something you kind of laughed at. College professors with funny glasses with rifles, wagons, and you can wind up keys on there. They're kind of funny. But things really changed after the situation.
One of the unusual things about this country compared to Japan, which I don't understand really why, is the tremendous lack of loyalty to a company. And the jumping around of the top executives from one to the other. And also the tremendous salary difference between the working person and the top executives. It's much, much higher in this country than it is in Japan. In Japan, they stick with the company for a long time. They make good salaries over there, don't get me wrong. They make $100,000 a year plus all kinds of more benefits than we have, probably. But here, when the guy makes $1 million a year of salary, he's saying, wait a minute now, this is just, is this gross or not? And then they change. They keep jumping around from one to the other. And all they're after is a short-term profit instead of a long pull. They don't care whether the company goes down the tubes or not. If they can get their $1 million a year salary, they go somewhere else next year. And I think of one guy from Xerox, Archie McCarr, went to Enterprise Harvester. What happened to Enterprise Harvester? Mm-hmm. He's supposed to be a financial wizard.
Well, it's like the Japanese, I think it was Ben Hayden about a month or so ago, 6 weeks ago, talked with this Japanese, and Japanese normally tell you what you want to hear. Very hard to get on what they're really thinking. But like they said, the United States, no question about, they're the most honest country there is. It's the hardest place because, they just don't pay under the table like they do in other foreign countries. But he said there's one place that they are the most dishonest, and that is to their employer. And he went on to explain that. So there's so many things that we have in this country, but I still feel very strong that we've got the greatest country there is. And we can sit here and we can voice our own opinions, positive or negative. We really do have freedom. And we have a lot of things wrong, but I think what we should do is, first of all, count our blessings on all the things that we do have and make sure that we don't lose those.
I want to count my blessings, but I also want to make it work better.
I come from a little different situation than this we were talking about now, in the sense of I was pastor of a rural kind of suburban bedroom community, to whom to talk about a lot of what we just talked about now would be foreign. And it seems to me that I'm just trying to process things through the fact that they, like Rosa Parks, who never went on her mind, finding that with one day was radicalized enough to say, no matter what the expenses, I'm going to sit in the back of the or sit in the front of the bus.
She didn't even count the cost.
Yeah, I mean, I'm saying she just, she at some point, at that point in her life, she
was tired.
She said, yeah, I don't care, do what you will, I'm going to sit there. And that the other thing is that she brought forces to bear. She radicalized a community. It wasn't just Rosa Parks, but then it was people then who rallied behind Rosa Parks. And so what takes place in a community that radicalizes? And I think that most of us like to live in a community that sees itself as a normal, living day to day, keeping things smooth. And in some respects it does, at least where I am. There's a lot of Spanish, Mexican American farm workers in the area, but they seem to be hidden from people's minds.
Not until harvest time.
Right, but I mean, like my congregation, there's probably only a few that are involved in it. So that even a lot of them don't use them, but more recognized, and a lot of places in my particular congregation aren't. So they're trying to get them to talk about issues that other than are selfish, that appeal to their own. It's really kind of live and let live, and as long as things aren't going too bad. We're even talking about nuclear issue, which I think maybe one issue may be that we can all finally get radicalized around. But even that seems to be.
I think the one that surprised me was the Mormon Church and the racetrack theory of going throughout Utah finally got somebody a little upset.
Yeah.
It surprised me that the Mormon Church, of all churches, would say, no, we don't want it.
You know, you were talking about corporate business. I'd like to make a statement. I worked at Boeing, and the management had a lot of policies that were inhumane policies, and one of them was that they treated their personnel like machines, and they really did. And they picked managers who were dishonest, who would cheat, steal, lie to get the product out. And I don't think that this was an exception. I mean, Boeing is an exception. I think those kind of policies run throughout our nation in our big businesses. And I think what that has to be done if we're going to really change our business system is to attack some of the basic assumptions of basic personnel policies of our big corporations. Because if we treat our employees like they were machines, then how are we going to treat the public who we're supposed to be serving? With all these basic assumptions that are basically inhumane, and based on profit and greed, it's no wonder that we end up spending lots of money for things that are counterproductive to the greater good of the country. Just based on how can we make more money. I mean, my supervisor at Boeing, it was obvious that he was totally immoral, totally dishonest. I mean, he lied, cheated, he'd do anything to get us to produce, and the people above him were just encouraging it. I mean, if I was a supervisor, I would have fired him a long time ago, and I would have got rid of him. But here they did, they put him at the top, head supervisor.
To inject an optimistic note, I stayed with a friend in Boise a week ago who teaches at Boise State University in the School of Business Administration. And he's teaching a course in business ethics for management. And this is a new field, and all the other
universities and major colleges are jumping in on it. It's a required subject for their business administration students.
And when they, and then when it was all over, the people can tell you that they used to go around and have breakfast at different houses, and then on New Year's Eve, they did that. Here, I'm going to get through these real quick. Well, this was the miners. This is what you call miners' villages. This is Winston Camp. Again, that's Honeymoon Heights in a moonlight photo. Now we'll bring the ore out to the mill. A double recovery method. Now, one of the things that was interesting about this mine was that the cream of the engineering and mining metallurgy corps of the Northwest, this mine had in the form of a man by the name of a white Russian immigrant by the name of Viktor Zanadorov, that the ability to have the highest recovery rate on in milling, in recovering concentrate. In the mine, and it just so happened that the person who had the best record in the United States before him was the company president from Howe Sound, E.B. Schley, and I guess from what I can tell, Schley used to come up here and argue with Zanadorov, and they'd run up and down. It must have been an exciting, exciting debate between people interested in technology and what it was doing to make it a better world, and is doing to make it a better world. These are scenes of the mill, and that's the dock, and there's a fellow here today, Mr. Bryant, who helped move those barges down lake and up lake. And there are people here who hauled the those ore buckets on the ore trucks. Now, this is a picture taken by Mr. Penberthy, and he was sitting in the balcony, probably right over there, at the first New Year's Eve dance held in this room here. So while you might have Vespers, they had them too, but they had dances. The community Christmas tree, and you'll see some more of that. And there's the dance band. And if you probably spent some time with it, you could see your friends out there. Now, people didn't in Holden or any place else, people are proud. And they have their dignity and self-respect because they work and they have a few dollars in their pocket. But they all, people dress nicely and cared. Very important. People don't have to feel guilty for wanting to be, to have a little job security and a little prosperity. There's a view from the E.B. Schley hauling concentrate down lake. Now that's the way the town of Chelan looked in 1938 when they shut the town down for half a day and they called out the school band and they had a big speeches and celebration honoring this removal of this first concentrate. When have you ever heard of a town in this day and age in the United States of America shut down for a half a day in celebration of a piece of economic success? Usually life goes on as if it's something to take for granted. That was Holden's cabin up above Honeymoon Heights that had deteriorated, brush had covered it up, and it had deteriorated over the years. I believe the village has been able to locate with Callie Holden, Holden's oldest son, when he was up here shortly before he died, that cabin up there. Now I'd like to move now over to a child's view of Holden and just take a brief happy time out with you. And here we'll get off the boat at the Lady of Lake like we did today, and we're going to look at it through the view of a child. The children were pretty special to the people of Holden, and they treated them, very nicely, very carefully, very well. And they didn't spoil them, but they had a nice place for them. And one of the places they liked to take them in the summertime was to Lake Chelan to swim. So if you were a child, this was a big experience to go on a picnic and swim in Lake Chelan. Sometimes we swam naked and sometimes we wore suits. And children always were amazed by the fact that the water, though it was ice cold at Lucerne by the dock, was always up at that old man's lake up there called Donkey Lake, always warmer. So they were always intrigued by the warmer water at Donkey Lake and the bigger fish and the big planes, the seaplane that would come landing there in the lake. This is Donkey Lake, and they could paddle boats around that lake. But they could always go back to the big lake, and their parents would go down there, and they'd have picnics, and some would stop off and get some more refreshments, some more pop. And they'd float around in inner tubes, and then they'd see that it would get dark soon because the sun would go down behind these mountains. And they had their little inner tubes like everybody else did, and waded around the rocks and imagined beaches and everything else. And like any other kid in any other town, they had wading pools in their yards and, you know, played in the water and had a good time. Just a bunch of kids in Holden getting together in the summertime. Little kids, could have been from any time. And there were always people, you know, with little doll houses for their clubhouses for the girls and the boys. And here's a lady who's just given the neighbor girls some puppies. I believe her name was Edith Brewer, given them to these two little girls. I think they're the Breadstrand girls, or the Staley Breadstrand girls, I think. And of course, parents didn't like that. I guess for some of you people who are really worried about, you know, sex roles and all that, look at the girls are learning how to wash clothes at an early age. Now, nobody thought too much of that. You know, everybody had their own kinds of pets. Some had paper boys who ate dinner with them when they didn't pay them, and others had, you know, deer that they trained. I believe there's a pet deer down in the circle down here. You know, what a monster that deer is going to become. There's that nice little old lady who keeps giving away little puppies. Now, this is a very special time in Holden with their community club dues and that. Holidays like the 4th of July or Labor Day or whatever were times of great celebration and fun. Now, here's a scene at the picnic up at the above the ballpark, followed by games. And let's take a look at this day. All the pop you could drink, all the ice cream you could eat, all the hot dogs, all the food, and you could have all the people in the town were there to have a good time, followed by a big baseball game. The morning started off with races and money to be won by all the kids. Nobody seemed to lose. And they started very early, and the most important man there was the man holding the bag of money. And so they ran, and they had a good time, and no pushy parents, just kids having a good time. From the dues of people who paid to the community club to keep it in operation. Three-legged races, and races for little girls and little boys. Just having a good time. Big boys also, and big girls, and men and women with their three-legged races and their pie-eating contests and their log sawing contests and all that. Nice way to spend a morning on the 4th of July, huh? And then all of a sudden, at a certain time of the year, the weather changed. You could notice it because the peaks got a little colder. And also, it got a little different because the bigger kids were always down here at town in school. And here the grass has got a little frostier, and it looked like winter was coming on. And then all of a sudden, one morning you woke up, and it had come. And then one of the things you had to worry about was, of course, your... You know, how dark it got in the wintertime, and the mothers and fathers would always worry their children get too far out of town. They might go off and get caught in the dark outside in the snow somewhere. Completely unfounded. Now, to you people here, this is not a big adventure, but to a little child coming from downtown to the other part of town to visit a friend or vice versa, or going to town between the two sections, was a big adventure. You know, just a very big adventure. Now, this person was really rich. You want to know why this person must have been really rich from a child's point of view? Even in a miner's village, the person had a garage, and they had the ability to keep their car up there all winter long. That's a rich person. And parents worried about this very much, about the kids maybe sliding off in their sleds into the creek or going off on a ski trip and sliding down into a ravine. But they know it didn't hurt them. Railroad Creek. And it snowed, and it snowed, and it snowed. Again, this person was under a lot of what you call, I don't know what it is, but you call it peer group pressure. I don't know what your peers are, but there they are. No, this person is really in trouble. Now, somebody in here knows whose house this is. This walk is not well shoveled. This person's in deep trouble. Is it Harry Rinker? See, that's too narrow. That's obviously too narrow. It had to be reported to the superintendent. And the chief engineer will have to divert one of the shifts over there. Now, this is a picture of the back of a house, obviously. Is that laundry? That was a no-no, wasn't it, ladies? Then all of a sudden, at a certain time of the year, the weather began to change, and you began to see wood and fences.